clothes on my back is all I own. Everything is gone.
My signs has helped me, please. Get me off this rooftop. Can somebody rescue me? Can you hear the people crying? Crying in despair. Each day we're losing hope. Does anybody care?
Then it hit me. Ain't nobody coming to get me. No one feels my pain. Once again, the color of my skin reminds me things ain't changed.
Begging you for water again and again. Please don't make me drink the water that I'm standing in. Look me in the eye. Don't you just walk on by.
This is Hung Out to Dry, Hurricane Katrina, and the Color of Disaster, a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Just think, it took the weather, literally and figuratively, to rip the roof off of America's two biggest taboos, race and class.
We're speaking with Protep Chatterjee of Corporation Watch and Rita King, freelance writer who written a report for Corporation Watch.
The story, Big Easy Money, Disaster Profiteering on the American Gulf Coast. Well, why don't we begin with Protep and the issue of the pattern of profiteering, waste, and failure. What's happening in the Gulf with contracting?
Well, Rita's probably best able to answer that, since she's been there much more recently than I have. But just to put a little bit of perspective of the way we've approached this, I wrote a book called Iraq, Inc., and we've also produced a report called Afghanistan, Inc. We've examined over the last 5 years reconstruction, and Rita, you know, has done an amazing job of putting together some of the material from looking at, you know, the kind of analysis we've done in other places and taking that to the Gulf Coast to see what contractors, what agencies are involved, and then looking at what abuses have happened. And what is perhaps astonishing or perhaps not surprising at all is that the same agencies, the same companies, and the same problems that we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan are being seen in the Gulf Coast today. A year after the hurricane struck, there still is pretty much no reconstruction. They patched up the levees, cleared up some of the debris, but not all of it. And most people don't have any housing except FEMA trailers. But Rita, maybe you can tell a lot more, since you've been there twice more since I was last there in February.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to note that the Army Corps of Engineers, Bechtel and Halliburton, are using the same contract vehicles in the Gulf Coast as they did in Afghanistan and Iraq. And these are indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, open-ended contingency contracts that are being abused by the contractors on the Gulf Coast. And the problem is that they're cost-plus contracts that allow them to profit on everything they spend, which is an incentive to overspend. And we've been focusing on that, as well as talking to subcontractors who are often five or six layers down in the pyramid, who have been exploited because the prime contractors at the top that make the most money then subcontract the work and on until finally a smaller outfit at the bottom will hire workers. And very often, unfortunately, those workers are not paid or treated horribly because many of them are undocumented workers or people who are disadvantaged in other ways, and the threat of immigration is too much. And so the Gulf Coast right now, I think 100,000 Latino people have moved into the Gulf Coast as a result of this work, and largely brought there by corporations to complete these tasks for peanuts on the dollar if they're paid at all.
Who are these corporations, and who are the subcontractors? Are there any local businesses involved?
By local businesses, I assume you mean businesses local to the Gulf Coast?
Yeah.
There are a lot of local businesses involved, and that's another issue that we explored, because the numbers that are provided, for example, by FEMA or the Army Corps of Engineers, one local business that was particularly interesting was Coastal Environments Incorporated, and they initially had a $3.1 million contract to work on wetlands improvement, because keep in mind, if the wetlands are not taken care of and the levees aren't taken care of, the whole question of rebuilding becomes almost a moot point, because if there's another hurricane, it'll wipe out everything that's been accomplished. So they were given a $3.1 million contract, and after $150,000 worth of work, that contract was taken away from them, and they're a small local company in the area, and they've continued working in St. Bernard Parish out of a local obligation, a sense of decency and necessity in their community, but they're not being paid by FEMA. And so the question really becomes, how many of those millions of dollars that are being allocated on paper to wetlands renovation and those critical environmental issues and to local and or small companies, which is not always the same thing, how accurate are those numbers? I would argue that those numbers are completely inaccurate.
As I was coming here, I was listening to a report from NPR that was apologetic, was an excuse in many ways for this is a massive disaster. There's obviously going to be some contractual waste, some profiteering that goes on. But how are we to really understand? And Protap, you said that you could draw the parallel between Iraq and Afghanistan. Are we looking at essentially the same players? How are we to understand the waste and the failure of this flawed contracting system?
As Rita described, I think the issue of layers is very important. And what we describe in the report, we call sort of this construction, you know, this contracting pyramid. And so to give you an example from the report, there's a company called Phillips & Jordan that hired another company called L&J Contracting that was supposed to pay a man called Marty Ray to do debris hauling. And every time, you know, as you go down the layer, the amount of money paid is less. The people at the top, Phillips and Jordan, there's another big debris hauler called Ashbritt. These are companies that make a lot of money. They're well-connected. So they're at the top of the pyramid. And in fact, there's NBC did this investigation where they looked at Ashbritt, a big company connected to Jeb Bush, based in Florida, and they got $23 per cubic yard of debris to haul. And they hired another company called CNB Enterprises. CNB Enterprises, in turn, then hired another company whom they paid, and CNB Enterprises got $9 instead of $23. CNB contracted Amley Transportation, which got $8, who then hired a guy called Chris Hessler, who got paid $8 a cubic yard, and then Chris Hessler hired a guy called Les Nerdlinger, who was paid $3 a cubic yard. This is the problem, is that there is this pyramid where at the very top you have politically collected companies, and they make a lot of money. And then the actual workers get, you know, as Rita said, pennies on the dollar. We're talking about, out of that $23, $20 that's disappearing for overhead, administration, profit. Now, people talk about government bureaucracy. And that's absolutely true that too many government agencies, and there's all this red tape, and there's local and federal, and there's corruption. But what we've done, instead of solving that, we've added a new set of problems. This is really what you'll see in Iraq also, and in Afghanistan. In Iraq, for example, your listeners may remember the four men who were killed in Fallujah, who worked for a company called Blackwater. They were security guards guiding a food convoy, and they worked for a company called Regency Hotel in Kuwait, who worked for a company in Germany called ESS, who worked for a company in Houston called Halliburton. This is what's happening, is these big companies get the contracts, and then they subcontract. And 80% of the money just disappears in this pyramid, the set of layers. This is why work is not getting done. And this is why it's so inefficient, is because of this, you know, this contracting pyramid. And this is true of any contract you look at. The interrogators in Abu Ghraib, you know, they get a dollar compared to the $5 that we, the taxpayer, paid. So it's remarkably inefficient, totally unaccountable, and nothing gets done. And of course, the contrast, and Rita can tell you these stories, of course, is what local communities are doing to fix themselves up with no money from the federal government. So our taxpayer money is going to paying layers and layers of contractors. And why do they get their contracts? Well, it's because they're in Virginia, because they're in Washington, D.C. 30% of the contracts in dollar value went to companies in Virginia. Less than 17% went to companies in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama combined. Why is this? It's because the people in Virginia and Washington, D.C. have lobbyists. They're people who know the system because the people who work for them are the people who used to work for government. It is, you know, there's this revolving door going along. So they know how to apply for contracts. They get the contracts, and then they subcontract. And so local businesses get very little money. Little work gets done. And all the money gets sucked up by companies in Virginia or in Washington, D.C.
Rita, we hear that people can't move back because there's no water, there's no electricity. There's a similar question with regard to the New Orleans Electric Company, which you talk about.
Entergy New Orleans, which is a subsidiary of Entergy Corporation, which is headquartered, coincidentally, in New Orleans, but also owns Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant here in Westchester, which is how I ended up writing this report to begin with, because I've been writing about the nuclear industry and specifically Indian Point for almost 4 years now. And so there are a lot of issues related to Entergy New Orleans. They're asking for a community development block grant, $718 million, which amounts to shareholders being protected while ratepayers and taxpayers pick up the tab. And one of the issues that they're claiming hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage in brackish water that flooded over the levees and entered the distribution system and other issues. And I myself saw electric bills that people had received in New Orleans that were, say, $1,500, and then that amount would be crossed out with a storm credit, and then the bill would actually be $300, $400, or $500, which was still higher than people were used to paying, but the loss on paper is higher than the actual cost if you do the math. And so they're waiting, the community development block grants, I think any day now they may find out what the outcome of that's going to be, but they've declared bankruptcy, and so they're essentially shielded from bailing themselves out, which it raises a lot of issues here locally, because people fear that if an expensive problem happens at Indian Point, what is Entergy's level of responsibility? What's to prevent them from declaring bankruptcy? So there are local ramifications to the issue in New Orleans as well.
They've declared bankruptcy the entire corporation or just the New
Orleans? No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Entergy New Orleans, the subsidiary. Right, but again, there's a lot of layering, and corporations are shielded by layers, which demonstrates the manner in which the laws are set up to protect corporations at the peril of people who are affected.
Just to add one little thing to what Rita said, Entergy headquarters, or the main company, made a profit of $923.8 million profit last year. So just with their profits alone, they could have paid for this. Now, they should have been paying for insurance. There should have been some system by which, you know, they don't get to keep the profit and sell and have us, the taxpayer, pay for the losses and the ratepayers.
You know, I've always gotten a kick out of it. You know, it's such a sinister thing, of course, what one might be calling disaster profiteering. And Rita, I want to go to you, who we were speaking before we were on the air about the question of business Darwinism and the FEMA conference that you went down to. And I want you to lift up some of the issues that occurred there, because they're really very politically enriching to us. And I have to say that there's one thing that you said to me that really struck me, as you were, because you have such a heart and such a passion about the research that you've done. And I absolutely have to advocate that this report be gotten. And it's easy to get, and we'll tell you how to, but it's very important. And Rita, one of the things that you had mentioned just before we talk about business Darwinism is that the slaves who were brought over from Ghana carved in the wrought ironwork a symbol of Sankofa. And I just want you to mention that, because there's something so penetrating and rich in that imagery of New Orleans.
There really is. The early French settlers who came to New Orleans practically perished from the heat, and anyone who's been down there in the summer can understand that. And so slaves were brought from Ghana because the climate in Ghana matches so well to the climate in New Orleans. And the slaves were responsible for making most of the wrought iron work that still stands in the city today. And so the symbol of the Sankofa is a heart, and it has spirals on the inside and spirals on the outside. And it means, in order to build the future, you can't forget the past. And so I believe that the Sankofa should really be held up as the emblem of the rebuilding effort. Because from a Northeastern perspective, I grew up in Brooklyn. I thought I had a very savvy perspective on race. But it's critical for people to remember that New Orleans was a thriving slave trade hub, and the history of that city is still very much a part of the manner in which business is handled today. And so Katrina really only snapped the neck of an already broken system of poverty and corruption. It did not create the problem any more than it created the problem of the widespread violence that we saw post-Katrina in some of the neighborhoods that are already riddled with violence. This has been a problem, a perennial problem, forever in the city. So when people talk about rebuilding the city, the first thing I always wonder is in whose image and to what end? Because New Orleans, outside the French Quarter and the Garden District and other areas where there's money, New Orleans and much of the Gulf Coast was riddled with poverty and problems. And so I think the Sankofa is the perfect image for a conscientious rebuilding effort and a chance to elevate our national consciousness and really take responsibility for some of these core issues that have been kind of stuck under the rug as we think we've developed, but we haven't gotten very far away from our history.
And the issue of business Darwinism and the FEMA conference that you attended?
Sure. It was a GSA conference, and GSA is the largest contract procurement agency in the nation, and FEMA was also there, and it was very compelling because they were pairing small businesses with big businesses. And John Anderson of GSA was telling me that you can't leave it to business Darwinism anymore and expect that these small businesses will be able to evolve on their own. And so I interviewed the larger corporations that were being paired with the smaller ones, and some of the smaller business people who were present were genuinely trying to learn the process, which is an extremely complicated process to get on the schedule for government contract procurement. It's not as easy as people would think it might be. It's red tape, it's bureaucracy. And so they were really there to learn, but other people were there because they had already been burned by the process, and it was their only opportunity to get FEMA's ear or get GSA's ear. And so I was the only reporter present. I attended the entire conference. And so for 2 days, I interviewed these business owners who had been burned or just weren't getting paid, including Coastal Environments Incorporated, which I mentioned earlier. So I really wonder what shape this is going to take. And also, this was also the only time I was able to interview FEMA. And because I had been invited to the conference by GSA Director Loretta Doan, her office, and she's a Bush appointee, they all treated me in a very amicable manner and spoke to me very cordially and gave me a lot of information that I hadn't been able to get the entire time I was working on this project. And so it gave me an insight into, I mean, what are they going to be doing differently in the future? Because the real situation is, the claim is that the prime contractors need to be large enough. They need to have a pervasive enough infrastructure to be able to support the scope of the work that needs to be done. But the reality of the situation is they aren't conducting the work that's being done. So in theory, that's one thing, but in practice, it's really something else. And if the measure of a successful business in a capitalist system is too often size, so as these businesses grow, there aren't a lot of very small businesses that are capable of doing this work. So you run into, it's a real chicken or the egg problem, and I think that there needs to be an entirely new model, especially with all the technological advances that are available to keep track of these businesses, who they are, what they can do. And so I did notice at the conference that there was an additional focus on keeping digital records instead of, I guess, paper folders. I'm not sure what they were doing pre-Katrina. It obviously didn't really work out very well.
How does this whole process affect who gets hired, how they're treated, what the wages are like, and what the work process is like? Who is doing the work?
I'll tell you one thing about that is on September 7th, 2005, a week after Katrina struck land, President Bush suspended the Davis-Bacon Act, which protects workers' wages. And there was a gigantic uproar in response, and 2 months later, he reinstated it, but not retroactively. So all of the contracts, which was almost all of the major contracts, had been given by then, and so they are not protected, so the workers' wages were not protected, and so it was pretty much a free-for-all how they were being paid.
I had no idea it wasn't retroactive.
No, it wasn't retroactive.
Ken is sitting here looking absolutely aghast.
Yeah, aghast. It wasn't retroactive.
I thought it was a victory.
No.
My goodness. Yeah. Prothap, the issue of corporate profiteering and how money is lost and stolen, I want to continue to lift that up. I mean, what an enormous opportunity this should be for the country to put people to work to rectify the poverty that existed, to create good housing, affordable housing. I continue to be incensed at the enormity of the backwardness and by deliberacy of what is happening in the Gulf region.
Well, you have to understand the way the federal bureaucracy works and probably the local bureaucracy too is to follow a system, to follow rules. And the rules for giving contracts, you know, the federal acquisition regulations, these are 10,000 pages long. And so that's a huge problem because normally what would happen, what could happen is, you know, you would give money to local people who know best how to fix their own communities. And in fact, that's happening now because people are so fed up of waiting. They're doing it themselves. And Rita can tell you about how in Versailles, a community with a very large Vietnamese-American community, 45 out of 53 businesses have been restored, 90% of houses have been cleaned and gutted with no help from the government. Basically, what's happening is the government, in fact, is giving money to this company to accept debris, probably toxic waste also, in a landfill next to them. So rather than getting help from the government, they're actually getting poisoned by this waste, the Chef Mantua dump. There's another, the Ninth Ward, if you go there, I mean, it looks like the hurricane hit yesterday. It's totally devastated, and nobody's rebuilding anything there. I mean, they're still focusing on trailers and that sort of thing, whereas a community group called Common Ground, led by Malik Rahim, you know, has started to build houses, restore houses for people for free. And so those people are doing this thing very efficiently and very quickly, and they have volunteers. I heard Malik Rahim just yesterday talking about how somebody, a soldier volunteered from Israel, came all the way here, flew over here. I know there are people, I met kids when I was at Common Ground, who'd taken, you know, the Greyhound bus all the way from Oregon to come over there. And they are actually doing what the government is not doing. So communities can and do restore themselves. The problem, of course, is the government follows these rules that are supposed to protect local businesses and, you know, minorities, but in fact are just opportunities for companies to take advantage of taxpayer money. In fact, one of the main contractors, I forget, but Rita probably remembers this, claimed to be a small business when in fact they weren't. Was that Ashbert? Rita?
It was Ashbert. Not only small, but minority owned and woman owned. As Sally Perkins, as Randall Perkins' wife, he's the president of the company, and she was listed as the president. And then I found a federal form in which she was listed as a homemaker, and later he said he has been on the record saying that it was a clerical error, that she was listed as a, that the company was listed as a woman-owned or a minority-owned company. So yeah, they bend the rules to the point of breaking. But Prothop's point about the Versailles neighborhood and Common Ground, it raises an interesting question, though, because a lot of people, when I make that point, mistake what I'm saying to mean that the government shouldn't help, that these people just get back on their feet on their own. And obviously, I believe that our taxpayer dollars should be spent correctly, not in a wasteful manner, and funneled in an appropriate way so that people can get back on their feet. The scope of the destruction is horrifying, even a year later, even with the debris mostly removed. And so, but these neighborhoods have just, especially Versailles, just defied the odds and just got back up and running because many of the...
That's a Vietnamese neighborhood.
Mostly Vietnamese, and many of the people that I spoke with said, hey, we lived through the Vietnam War. So Katrina's just another unfortunate incident in a long history of misfortune. So they were able to roll with it. And it seems to be, and many of the people I interviewed, seems to be an indication just of the relative youth of this nation and the fact that we haven't seen the scope of this sort of damage before. And so we're learning how to cope. But with that said, one of the greatest core American values is the ability to pull oneself up by the bootstraps and move on. And so I think Katrina is really a test of our national values and how we bounce back from this. It's one thing to chronicle what's already happened, but it's critical to remember as media attention wanes after the first anniversary that the rebuilding effort is still ahead.
And we're going to have to leave this part there. Now, the major question, big easy money, disaster profiteering on the American Gulf Coast. How do people get a copy of that report? Rita J. King.
They can visit CorpWatch, CorpWatch.org. And there's also information on my website, RitaJKing.com.
Prothap Chatterjee and Rita J. King, thank you so much for spending this time with us. And I must again tell you that if you want to know about the debris removal and the labor wars and the rebuilding at what cost and community versus cronyism, this report is absolutely imperative for you. And I compliment CorpWatch and Rita for the enormous work putting this together and getting it out to us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure speaking with both of you.
Tell me, didn't it rain, children?
Didn't it
rain, oh my Lord? Didn't it,
oh,
didn't it, oh,
didn't it,
oh my Lord?
Didn't it rain,
didn't it
rain?
Tell me, didn't it rain, children?
Didn't it
rain, oh my Lord?
Didn't it,
oh,
didn't it,
oh,
didn't it,
oh my Lord?
Didn't it rain,
didn't it rain?
Well, it rained 40 days and it rained 40 nights. Well, no land, nowhere in sight. God sent a raven to spread the news, hoisted his wings and away he flew, to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south. Oh, tell me, didn't it rain?
Oh,
yeah.
Didn't it rain, oh, my Lord?
Didn't it,
oh,
didn't it,
oh,
didn't it,
oh, my Lord?
Didn't it rain?
Didn't it rain?
Well, it rained 40 days, 40 nights without stopping. Lord got word when the rain kept dropping. Sent out a raven, sent out a dove. What a good God came down from above. Tell me, my God, when it started to rain, women and children, they begin to scream.
You're listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report special, Hung Out to Dry, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Uptown, kept raining. Everywhere, well, the water kept dropping.